I'm going to talk mostly about what we understand about what the connection and interaction between the intergalactic medium and galaxies at redshifts between about 2 and 3.5. And the reason that this funny range of redshifts is chosen, of course, is because it's the place where we have simultaneously dynamic range in the intergalactic medium, and we have the ability to identify and study galaxies in the same volumes. So the idea is to take this something like this cartoon. The idea is to look at classical absorption line studies of the IGM in a volume, and also look at the distribution of star-forming galaxies in the same cosmological volume, and see how they relate to one another, sort of do zeroth order tests of our understanding of what's going on, and to place constraints on whatever environmental influences might exist of the galaxies on the IGM. And in this way, more or less using the IGM as a laboratory to understand an otherwise relatively inaccessible aspect of galaxy formation, which is this whole feedback question. So that's going to be the focus today. What I'll start out doing, though, is putting into context the kinds of galaxies we're talking about, because that'll be fairly relevant to interpreting what they might be doing to the IGM. So I'll talk a bit about what we know about the galaxy properties in that particular range of redshifts, and then I'll briefly go over some results that many of you have seen before on an initial study of this kind at redshifts of around 3. Unfortunately, this meeting is happening about a month too early for me to really tell you everything that we know about a much larger sample going down to redshift 2, but I'll give you a preview of some of that stuff. And also I'll talk at the end about the future and the prospect of using galaxies instead of quasars as probes of the intergalactic medium now and in the future. So I'm not going to belabor where the galaxies come from and all that kind of thing. Suffice it to say that they're photometrically selected to make spectroscopy efficient in a prescribed redshift range, and mostly I'll be talking about the green and blue types of samples ranging between about 2 and 3.5. They're more or less the same population of objects at those two ranges of redshift, and I won't go into that too much, but you can treat them as a sort of sample of star-forming galaxies in the redshift range 2 to 3.5. A lot of what we know about the physics of these things comes from the spectra, and I don't want to bore everyone with any details or anything, there are lots of them, but suffice it to say that from the spectra we learn about the kinematics of what's happening to the interstellar media of these things. And in general, the lines that you see in absorption from the interstellar medium are not at rest with respect to the galaxy. They're always blue shifted, always blue shifted. And Lyman alpha emission, when it's seen, is essentially always red shifted. And you get all sorts of mixtures of combinations of Lyman alpha emission, Lyman alpha absorption. And I should say that if the redshift 6 universe is anything like it is at redshifts 2 or 3, the most luminous objects are the least likely ones to have Lyman alpha emission. And so if you do a Lyman alpha emission selected sample, I'm not sure you're actually seeing the objects that are actually producing, that have the highest star formation energies. that's hard to see, but what this shows is the sort of average difference between the Lyman alpha emission redshift and the interstellar medium absorption redshift. It's about 600 kilometers per second, and the lines themselves, the interstellar medium lines, tend to be about 600 or 700 kilometers per second wide. And so the extrema of the velocity of the outflows tend to be at around, indicate wind speeds of something like 600 kilometers per second. This is typical. This is not just extreme cases. And this is the cartoon of course, one simple-minded way of interpreting the observed kinematics. We're here. We're seeing the outflow coming toward us, and we're seeing Lyman alpha emission scattering off the backside of the outflow. And you get In the best studied cases, like this particular one, you can see you have outflowing gas that goes out to about 800 kilometers per second blue shift. And similarly, you have emitting gas, Lyman alpha emitting gas, that goes out to 1,000 kilometers per second red shifts. So we're talking about very large velocities involved. And there's no reason to believe that this one is very unusual at all. This just happens to be gravitationally lensed so that we get much better spectra. And I also should say that this material that's flowing out is inherently multiphase. We see ions from oxygen 1 to oxygen 6 in this with the same range of velocities, but it's definitely not the same stuff. Okay, it's a really complicated mess, no doubt, if we could actually see what it looks like, which we can't, which is a good thing, because then it would be too complicated to understand. The way that we establish what the rest frame, what the systemic redshifts of the objects, which is important to interpreting a lot of these things, is with nebular optical lines, which requires infrared spectroscopy, which is very difficult compared to the optical spectroscopy, but we it is possible to do that, and it's being done. I should just mention that I should just mention that from these different kinds of spectra, you learn a lot of other things, like information on the IMF, which got cut off for reasons that are, I have no idea. Photospheric abundances, interstellar medium metallicity. I already talked about the kinematics of the ISM. And from the near-infrared spectra, you get an idea about the kinematics, the ionized gas metallicity, the star formation rate estimate. And the most golden thing for this game is that you get the systemic redshift of the galaxy, which is otherwise unavailable. So this is just a small subset of the objects for which those H-alpha or O3 spectra are available. And this just shows the velocities of the interstellar medium lines against the velocities of the Lyman alpha emission relative to the systemic redshift here. And in cases where we can check, the stars in the galaxy are at the same redshifts as the nebular emission. So that's a pretty good measure of that. So that's just... And we don't see any huge differences in a sample at redshift 3 and redshift 2. Okay, so how much energy are these things producing? Well, there are lots of ways of estimating star formation rates, none of which work very well. But when you compare several of them and they give you the same answer, then there's some reason to believe that you might have it close to being right. And that's what we've done in this particular case for a sample of, at around the redshift of 2, where you stack the X-ray positions in the Chandra Deep Field North, you stack the radio positions, and you compare those to the UV, and you get about 50 solar mass per year inferred star formation rates from the X-ray and radio, and about 8 or 9 from as the average star formation rate as estimated from the UV. And that gives you an average UV attenuation factor of about a factor of 5, which is exactly what you would have predicted from looking at the UV colors of those objects. So it all kind of hangs together. But the important point, which many people may not realize, is that a typical galaxy has a bolometric luminosity of a few times 10 to the 11, which if it were in the present day universe, people would call it a luminous infrared galaxy. So these are not small starburst galaxies, they're big starburst galaxies. And in fact, if you look at objects that are brighter in the rest frame optical, they get even more luminous, 130 solar masses per year, typical star formation rates, when you go to a sample that's bright in the observed K-band. And you also find that brighter objects optically are also more reddened in the far ultraviolet continuum. And you can see here, this is a sort of average galaxy at a redshift of 3, and this is the average of about 30 very bright rest frame optical galaxies at redshift of 2. The point is that we're talking about luminosities that approach EULERG type things in fairly common objects. The AGN fraction is, of course, a bit difficult to estimate, and this is apparently relevant because there's going to be a lot of discussion about how AGN feedback fits into the whole picture. From what we've seen so far, the AGN fraction among objects that we've looked at spectroscopically is a few percent, 3 or 4%, and you get more or less the same answer whether you look at X-ray selected objects or objects that are identified based on their ultraviolet features. And so this may be a duty cycle, an indication of a duty cycle, if it's the case that these things live in the same dark matter halos as the galaxies identified in the same surveys. There are ways of testing that that I won't have time to talk about today. So what about the masses? We've just finished what I hope is the final word for the time being on clustering properties of these things, and has some interesting results. And more or less, it's just a very large sample. And so now the numbers are pretty clean. And this is samples at redshift 3 and redshift 2. And down here, it's hard to observe the IGM, so you can ignore that particular bin if you want to. The important point that one has been making all along, but that where this illustrates fairly clearly, is if you try to match the clustering properties of the galaxies to dark matter halos in a concordance cosmology simulation, you get characteristic numbers of around 10 to the 12 solar masses. And that seems to be the case across this redshift range, more or less. It gets a little bigger as you go from 3 to 1.7. But if you follow those same halos forward in time, they would have clustering properties at a redshift of 1 that are similar to the early type galaxies in people's redshift 1 redshift surveys. And if you follow them to redshift 0, they would cluster only like elliptical galaxies in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So whether they look like ellipticals or not at high redshift, they look like them in terms of clustering properties by the time you get to low redshift. That just says more or less the same thing. It also turns out that the clustering is dependent on the luminosity. This just shows, as a function of rest frame optical luminosity, what the co-moving correlation length is. And you can see that there's very strong clustering segregation as a function of optical luminosity, going from about 4 at the faintest objects to about 10 at the for the most luminous objects. In terms of the stellar masses, I'm going to go through this very quickly because this is largely irrelevant to this crowd. But when you get long wavelength data, you can, like Spitzer, you can check on stellar mass estimates that you might have been a little bit less certain about based on just going out to the observed near infrared. And in fact, we've been able to do this with some data that were taken in one of our survey fields. And if we look at the 72 galaxies that have the long wavelength observations, typical redshift is around 2.25. A significant fraction of them are actually very massive, greater than 10 to the 11 solar masses. That's for saltpeter. So divide by whatever, 1.8 for your favorite IMF. And this is what the distribution looks like. It's got a sort of average logarithmic stellar mass of around 10.4, and it looks more or less log normal with a tail that goes out close to 10 to the 12. This is just to illustrate that you actually get the same answer whether you have the Spitzer data or not, but you just have a much cleaner result with the Spitzer data. this is just showing mass to light ratios. The only point that I wanted to make here is this distribution of stellar masses. You start seeing things that actually look quite mature in terms of their mass to light ratios compared to objects in the redshift zero universe. And these are all objects that are still forming plenty of stars. One little nice anecdotal piece is that one of the field in fact that has the Spitzer data is one that has a large spike in redshift space at around a redshift of 2.3. And it's interesting to look at the inferred properties as a function of environment in that field. And this is what you get. If you look at the inferred age from the population fitting, from the fitting of the models, objects within that spike stand out clearly in an age versus redshift diagram. And you can see that while there is a trend for things at lower redshift to be older, which you would hope, in general, you can see that this extends way up to things that are almost as old as the universe, ostensibly. And the average age is about 700 million years older within that structure than it is outside of it.
What's the age of the universe?
Oh, it's about what is it, 3.5, 3, 3.5, something like that. So that structure will almost certainly be a rich cluster by redshift 0 and probably by redshift of 1. It's an overdensity of about 6 or 7 in galaxies, and that corresponds to a mass overdensity of something like a factor of 3 or so. And it's definitely the case that, at least within that sample, where something is has a lot more to do with when things happen than anything else. So this is a summary of the properties of typical redshift 2 star-forming galaxies that I'm going to talk about in a minute in the context of the IGM, and bright ones. So the bright ones extend to the kinds of things that we call massive galaxies in the present universe. The typical ones have less extreme properties. Metallicities of a half solar or so is typical, whereas solar is typical of the bright ones. Interestingly, though, the spectra don't seem to indicate any big difference in the speed of the outflows that are this ubiquitous feature of these galaxies. Relatively small galaxies and relatively big ones seem to have comparable kinematics in that sense. So, what about the IGM? Well, this is our first crack at doing this in six fields with high-resolution spectra, where one surveys the foreground galaxies in a delta Z of 0.5 swath and about a 10 arc minute field in front of and surrounding that quasar line of sight. And this was one of the tantalizing results, was that if you sat on each galaxy and asked what is the optical depth in the Lyman Alpha forest surrounding me going as a function of radius, you can see that this is the average place in the Lyman Alpha forest here. And not unexpectedly, when you sit on galaxies, you see excess H1 absorption, because there's more H1 where there's more mass and more galaxies. If it didn't look like that, we'd be pretty worried about all the models. But then it seemed like, whereas simulations would have predicted that this would continue, where you'd have stronger and stronger absorption as you got closer to the galaxy, it didn't seem to really do that. And in fact, there was a tantalizing hint that something might be turning around on scales less than about 1 co-moving megaparsec. And one might say, well, maybe it's possible that something that the galaxies are doing is messing up one's expectations. If you didn't really believe that that was significant, and you would have lots of reasons perhaps not to, since it's all based on a relatively small number of objects, it's about 5 objects that reverse that trend. And there are problems in estimating the redshifts for reasons that I've already told you about. And we didn't have the benefit of the accurate redshifts from the near-infrared spectra at that time. And so you can see that the answer you get depends on how accurately you know the redshift. So you might be worried about that. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But another way to look at everything is to compare where the metals are versus where the galaxies are. And at the time, this is what the autocorrelation function for galaxies looked like, correlation length of about 4 megaparsecs. And this is what the galaxy versus metal cross-correlation function looks like. And more or less what this says is that carbon 4s that one can detect are essentially in the same places that the galaxies are. They're slightly less correlated than the galaxies themselves. And of course, it includes the bulk of the carbon 4s are very weak ones, of course, because in any sample, the weak ones will dominate by number.
Hey, Chuck, what is your color density
selection? It depends on the line of sight, but it goes down to about 10 to the, little less than 10 to the 12 in carbon 4. So we had, 1422, for example, went way down, and that was one of the few.
Just take all the carbon 4s.
Just lump it all in one big pile, yeah. For that particular experiment. This is one where we marginalize over a certain spitting distance of and say, what is the strength of the correlation between galaxies and carbon 4s on scales less than about 3/4 of a co-moving megaparsec versus the galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation function. And you can see that at 10 to the 13 column densities in carbon 4, you start getting cross-correlations that are stronger than the galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation. And the simplest interpretation of that is that these systems here are produced by exactly the same object that you're seeing near the line of sight. It's hard to make a cross-correlation exceed an autocorrelation without having that be true. Then you can ask the question, what fraction of the observed carbon-4 systems are produced by, or within that same distance of an observed galaxy? And that fraction is very high at the highest column densities, and it's still 50% as you make this transition here. So let me move on to what to much larger samples at somewhat lower redshifts, where we're starting to look at the possibility not only of using more QSO sightlines, but also using galaxy spectra rather than background quasar spectra. And since the forest observes very rapidly over this range, it's interesting to ask whether the relationship between galaxies and the forest does as well. Well, this is the idea in this new approach, is where you choose fields that where you have lots or multiple background quasars. They're easier to find at lower redshift because there are more quasars, period. And then doing a relatively comprehensive survey of galaxies that are chosen to be in the foreground. In this particular field, there were three or four known quasars, and we found three or four more to act as additional sight lines. And the spectra, of course, vary in quality depending on how bright the background probes are. So if you ask the question, well, have they evacuated a hole around them? The answer is some of them and some of them not. So this is a much more believable version of that plot that showed an inverse of that correlation between optical depth and distance from a galaxy. And what this is showing is that the expectation, this is actually a simulation by Kohlmeier et al., and I think it was provided to us just about a week ago so that we could make this plot. This is the expectation where you would have almost no objects within one co-moving megaparsec, no places where you would find no H1 gas, thank you. Whereas what you actually see is that you find that you either have optically thick H1, which is over at this side, or you have essentially no H1 optical depth at all. So it departs significantly from one's naive expectations, but it also isn't quite as clean as this complete reversal that one saw in the redshift 3 sample. And this is mostly objects at around a redshift of 2 to 2.5, but it includes a handful of objects at higher redshift. The reason is simple. We can't get this kind of precision on the galaxy redshifts unless we have nebular lines in clean places with respect to the near-infrared bands, and that's relatively hard. This is a new analysis of that whole cross-correlation of galaxies and metals. And now we're including 575 carbon-4 systems in about 1,100 galaxies. This is the autocorrelation for the galaxies, and you can see, again, that the carbon-4s become the cross-correlation of carbon-4 systems in galaxies exceeds that of the galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation function for column densities greater than 10 to the 13. So I think this is further evidence that strong systems, at least, are causally connected to the actual galaxies that you're observing. So, but how can you really prove that the galaxies you see are perturbing anything? What, you know, perhaps they're just sitting in places where metals were formed a long time ago, you know, population 3, blah, blah, blah. But is there a way to actually search for the smoking gun? Well, that's what we're trying to do now. And the only way that you can do that is by having fields with very, very good QSO spectra, and by surveying and by looking at the galaxies that are relatively close to the line of sight in those fields. And here's an example where you have a galaxy with quite well-known properties. It's got an outflow speed of 500 kilometers per second or so. It's about 120 kiloparsecs from the line of sight. It's got solar metallicity, a high star formation rate. It's quite bright, has a large stellar mass, and yet it appears to be producing. Now, this particular field has lots of questions still associated with it, which I won't have time to go into. However, it appears to be producing very strong lines and unusually broad and diffuse lines of these high ionization features And the actual place, this is the galaxy redshift here. You can see it's more or less these broad troughs are centered on the galaxy systemic redshift, and the Lyman alpha is offset a bit. It's a relatively weak Lyman alpha, and it's off somewhere else in velocity space. Here are a couple more examples where we're looking at oxygen 6, and these spectra are actually taken from work by Simcoe, Sargent, and Al. And we just happen to have galaxy information for this particular field. Here's a system that has every ion known to man and detectable in the far ultraviolet. And it's at a redshift of 2.3. It's 115 kiloparsecs away from the line of sight. And here's one. This is a quite massive galaxy. It's about 10 to the 11 solar masses in stars. This one is much dirfier, and it's actually farther away. And the association, I would say, is a little bit less secure. Nevertheless, the systemic redshift of the galaxy kind of sits in the middle of this kind of broad, diffuse complex of oxygen 6 that extends over something like 1,000 kilometers per second, with the galaxy more or less sitting somewhere in between. That was a physical distance. So this is what, just in that one line of sight, these are galaxies that we know about. As a function of redshift and angular separation, excuse me, from the QSO sight line. And the ones with known oxygen 6 systems are indicated here. And you can see that there's a very strong association with galaxies we are capable of identifying, which makes them have to be big and bright, and the observed O6 systems. And they also tend to be associated with these carbon 4 complexes. where you have several components spread over several hundred kilometers per second. And this tends to happen within, 20 or 30, 40 arc seconds. So that's, a couple hundred kiloparsecs physical. You can also start playing around with not limiting yourself to finding galaxies near the extremely rare, very bright quasars, but instead finding pairs of galaxies where one is foreground to the other. One would like to actually probe the physics of this presumed outflow at various distances from its source. And here's a case where we have two objects separated by 2 seconds of arc or so. One's at 1.6 and one's at 2.2. And it turns out that you see the outflow from one in the spectrum of the other. The line is stronger in the spectrum of the background. The absorption lines are wider in the spectrum of the background object at the redshift of the foreground one than they are looking right down the barrel to the foreground object itself. And the absorption in this spectrum at this redshift is at the systemic redshift of this guy here. So it's more or less what you would expect if you sort of had a spherical outflow and you're basically cutting across the entire velocity width as you go through the line of sight. So that's an interesting case, one of several that we're studying. Here's another one where you have a background at 2.1, foreground at 2.0, and here's the spectrum of the background galaxy, and this is hard. It's like 20 hours of integration, but you get it along with, 30 or 40 other things. And I'm not sure how well you can see it, but you actually see absorption at this redshift in the spectrum of this object. It's about 43 proper kiloparsecs away. And what you see is that the high ions are much stronger at a distance of 43 kiloparsecs relative to the low ions than they are down right looking down the barrel. So the low ions are petering out, relatively speaking, by the time you get out to that distance along in this particular situation. For example, this is the carbon 4 line, and that's the associated silicon 2, whereas in this background galaxy, that's the silicon 2 line, and this is carbon 4 here. Another example. What we're actually doing now is realizing that if you want to prove causality, you really have to find examples with really good spectra. And at the same time, we're actually trying to test the effects of the radiation on the intergalactic medium of famous bright quasars who already have good spectra in the literature or in archives. Here's one example with a phone number that probably almost all the observers know by heart, PHL 957. And this is basically the radius within which one has to search for things that might be having a direct influence on that line of sight in the intergalactic medium. And you can also look on much larger scales at the impact of that, the radiation from this 16th magnitude quasar on the IGM. So what, you can actually look at background spectra of galaxies. And here are two examples. That's that one, and that's that one. And not surprisingly, when you look at the redshift of the quasar along the line of sight in the Lyman Alpha Forest of the galaxies, it's a local maximum because that the quasar, as expected, is completely obliterating the H1 in its immediate vicinity. But this is just a specific example of a sort of general idea that you can start to almost get three-dimensional maps of the gas and also test for quasar lifetimes and things like that all at the same time. And so my summary is just that feedback is real. It's very real. Even if you can't make it happen in your simulation, it's still real. It's everywhere. There's evidence that it influences things on physical scales of several hundred kiloparsecs around these rapidly star-forming galaxies. It happens. We can only say that it happens for massive galaxies, and it looks like it's important for massive objects. We don't observe things that aren't massive, so we have no idea what's going on with them. I don't think I'm interested by the recent interest in AGN feedback, because there are several things that one might expect to see that one doesn't, and things that I don't understand if AGN are really having a significant influence. And this might be an interesting topic for discussion. But for the time being, since I'm out of time, I'll stop. Thank you.
It's not a very well-formed question,
maybe you can answer it in an equal sort of fashion. But Sargent and Rauch did these studies of quasar pairs,
right,
of course, and that gives a correlation length which you can sort of compare with this,
right,
type of material. But they also saw relatively quiescent structures, if I remember correctly. That is to say, there wasn't very much kinematic difference as a function of quasar separation over the region where they saw things. Whereas somehow in the picture that's being described here, where things are emanating right from the galaxies, I would have thought there'd be much more kinematic structure in that sort of thing, and that depending on just exactly where you looked, right, you'd see a lot of velocity structure.
Well, I think it's still the case that the fraction of the volume of the intergalactic medium that's affected is small. And that actually, if you look at what they said, I believe what it says is that they see evidence for things being stirred only in cases where you have H1 columns larger than a certain number, like 10 to the 14 or something like that. And that I don't think any of these galaxies you wouldn't find H1 quite nearby with at least that kind of column density. So these are relatively small volumes that represent only a small fraction of the wiggles that you see in a Lyman Alpha Forest spectrum, but probably involves a significant fraction of the mass and of the metals associated.
So if I can try and pin this down just a little more.
Sure.
I mean, you're seeing correlation down to 10 to 13 feet, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, presumably, those systems are somehow structures, right, that are galaxy-generated,
yeah,
right? And then when you go back to the LBG thing, the material, I mean, you have to get out to those sort of happening. So really do need the sort of velocity talking.
Right.
And then somehow intuitively you'd expect, just depending on where you penetrate the sphere, or which particular cloud components you get, that those sort of structures should somehow be manually present in that way. Maybe you could somehow see that was there in the way.
Right. I think what you would see is somewhat different multiplicity in the carbon 4 doublets or something like that, which they did see, and I think there were energetic arguments made, but I'd have to look again to, my recollection is that there isn't anything in conflict, because the part that's quite quiescent is not the part that we're claiming anything is influencing in general.
Yeah, in the 1620 free field, you had quite a few quasars, a good spectrum, lots and lots of galaxies.
Yeah.
You showed us individual examples, you know, of where you were seeing absorption, presumably caused by the galaxy or very close to it. But I don't think you gave us a fraction of times absorption was occurring. So, you know, if I'm a galaxy and I'm a megaparsec away from a sight line, what's the chance that I'll see carbon 4 or indeed anything?
Yeah,
do you have those numbers yet?
Well, I mean, it's hard when you've got a very large range of sensitivity among the quasar spectra. For the best quasars, that number is very high.
Out to what distance?
It does look like it's you know, 200 to 300 kiloparsecs proper.
Physical distances. At what point does that just start to be absorption from the sort of structure around the galaxy?
Well, at column densities of 10 to the 13, that's when you make the transition, apparently, from things that are associated with objects that you see to things that are associated generally with the large-scale structure in carbon-4 column density.
Given the fact that we see the metals, one is tempted to assume that the outflows have to do with supernova-driven winds.
Right.
But in reality, they could also be associated with quasar activity. In other words, the quasar has the advantage of providing an impulse of energy over a short time, amount of time from a given point. And even though the metals are produced by supernovae, they may be driven out of the galaxy by the quasar activity. And the fact that the duty cycle is so small would not allow you to see the quasar at the time that you're observing the outflow. Do you have any hidden arguments against the AGN providing the outflows?
I don't have anything that I can prove, but I have things that I would have expected to see that worry me that one doesn't. And for example, when you see relatively low luminosity quasar-looking things that have UV luminosities that are no larger than that of something during its star formation phase, they don't have any they don't have any evidence of an interstellar medium, the way that the objects forming stars do, and I don't understand why that would be, since unless you always see faint quasars after they were just bright, 5 minutes ago, which is possible. But if you ask me based on what I've seen, the quasars happen pretty much after almost all the star formation is done. And I can tell you why I think that, it would take too long. But I think that's where things seem to be pointing.
Chuck, what could you say about the geometry of the outflows? Are they spherical or directional? The cases where you see transparency.
I mean, the fact that you see outflowing material in every case, the level of it changes, the depth of the lines, which is more or less a covering fraction effect, changes. But I think that you see it every time, and so there's something happening everywhere. But it's probably thick. It's probably more extensive along certain lines of sight than others. There's so many assumptions in that kind of a calculation, even for good observations. But like local starbursts, it looks like it's at least as large as the star formation rate. It's got to happen, right? You got to get metals out there, and you got to get more metals out there than you keep in the galaxies, and this is how it's happening, I think. What is the fraction of mass in the outflows that we observe? Fraction of what mass?
Gas mass.
Well, we don't measure the mass of the outflow. Well, we don't know where the gas is, and that's why we're trying to measure it at different radii, because unless you know the radius, you have no idea what the flux is. But what fraction is it? During the typical lifetime of a few hundred million years of one of these star formation episodes, you know, multiple. It's roughly the same as the fraction turned into stars, which is a small fraction of the baryonic mass of the halos, if you believe the halo masses. The fraction that goes into stars is like 8% in one of these typical things, and so it could be somewhere between, say, 8 and 20 or 30% of the gas that gets driven out.
Following up on this question of the geometry, no one has raised the question yet as to what part of the absorption might be due to infall instead of outflow. So could you say something about whether there is any evidence that requires that it be outflow versus infall, and could there be some infall, as in a galactic fountain that's circulating?
If you can make infall always look blue shifted, then there are lots of ways, but unless you can do that, then it...
Why don't you see the backside outflow?
Well, because you don't have a source against which to see it.
You mean to say you never are looking at a background source, which is further away than the foreground object?
No, we're looking right down the barrel where the stars are forming.
But when you have these background quasars and you're correlating the galaxy with the absorption, then you're looking from further away.
Yeah. Well, okay. Then you have the problem of you can only make a statistical association of absorption with a particular galaxy.
But you can still see if the offset between the redshift of the galaxy and the redshift of the absorption supports the possibility that some of it is on the other
side. It's symmetrical in that sense.
So you don't know. From that, you don't know whether it's infall or outflow.
No, but since you see outflow on our side, I would claim that that's pretty strong evidence that outflows are more important. You don't see redshift of gas in absorption against the continuum of the stars. Right. I'm certain that infall exists, but it doesn't produce absorption that's anywhere near as strong as the outflows.
Getting back to this issue of mass and momentum and energy flux, I know it's large ionization corrections and all that. So, first simple question is, can you estimate whether the gas is collisionally, shock, or photoionized? Secondly, with the, I know it's a very difficult thing to do, but can you estimate the relative masses in different phases? So like the 06 phase, what fraction of the material has effective kinetic temperatures that are so high? And then finally, is there any estimate of the correlation of, in other words, these things will not only be proto-clusters, but also proto-groups, and they're going to be filling up the universe at some level. And can you estimate sort of how much of the metals is getting out? I know these are very uncertain for the first question, but do some guesses.
I mean, the problem is the range of temperatures over which you can see anything is very limited. You know, probably most of the gas is at inaccessible temperatures. And, you know, because you see this multi-phase medium, you can't make ionization corrections because it's a mess. And, you know, you have, I guess the picture is that you have a hot medium and you have colder condensations inside of that, and you have everything in between. And you see the O6 at the intersections of the hot and the cold gas, and you see the O1 when you go through the cold stuff. It's pretty hard to disentangle the line widths from the kinematic effects. It's pretty difficult. Well, I think when you find, you know, single carbon 4 systems, it's easy to tell whether it's 10 to the 5th or 10 to the 4th degrees, but that isn't the common manifestation of this.
Just a quick one, Chuck. You argued that the carbon 4 systems that have 10 to the 13 and above comb densities are causally connected to the Lyon-Bragg galaxies. And I guess what I'm curious about is that roughly 90%, maybe 95% of damp systems have carbon 4 comb densities in that excess. By inference, would you say that those are causally connected to Lyon-Bragg galaxies?
oh. I don't think we are as good at answering that converse question as we are the other way around, because we don't know our incompleteness. You know, we can ask, do you see carbon-4 from this galaxy? But we don't, you know, our sample is not complete spectroscopically, photometrically, or any other way. You know, my guess is the damp Lyman alpha systems, if you were sufficiently sensitive, you would find them, and they occupy all parts of the luminosity function. Because they're not luminosity selected, though, they're much less likely to appear in this sample than the ones that are. I think it's quite possible that they are. I don't have any strong reasons. I think they might be, on average, less massive objects than the things that are bright enough for us to see directly.
How far down the luminosity function do you go? The reason I ask is that we've seen before that the metallicity luminosity relationship indicates that those very massive galaxies that you were referring to, that those retain most of their mass.
Yeah, here's the problem. In the range of UV luminosities that we look at, there's almost zero correlation between, say, stellar mass and UV luminosity. It's a complete scatter. And that correlation only becomes evident as you go to longer wavelengths. And so how far we go down the luminosity function may not be all that relevant. I think we go farther down the luminosity function because we go to the same apparent magnitude at redshifts of 2 as we do at 3. So a bit farther, maybe 7/10 of a magnitude farther down, factor of 2 in luminosity, farther down the luminosity distribution. But then, you know, our spectroscopic sample tends to be somewhat biased toward the brighter ones. And that, you know, you'd have to fold that in too.